The title of the talk today is Operating Theater. And I don't think I have encouraged you enough to feel free to ask questions while I'm talking. It's not just only allowed for me to talk during this time. There was a teacher named Gurdjieff, who's fairly modern, who was eccentric, like probably most real teachers. And so he was willing to say things that were hard to hear. And one of the things that he said that I think is hard to hear, but good to hear, it's almost like catching a ball and getting the breath knocked out. He had a kind of system that people could look into to find out what their, let's say, operating system was, what their main way of operating in the world is. But he said, actually, there are these 9 different possibilities, and we're all a combination of them, but we may have a main mode out of the 9. But it's almost impossible to guess what your own number is, what your own operating system is, what your own, like, basic programming or basic MO, we say now, I guess. So there's this possibility that there's this vast blind spot that we're working within. And if that's true, and if it's not a tragedy, then what? One thing that could be possible, if the way that we're all going about our lives is actually hidden to us, is a blindness, is a way of operating that we do not see in ourselves. Some people maybe are more motivated by fear. Some people maybe more by anger, for example. Some people more by trying to get the right surface appearance. And we don't know that that's what's moving us. It's almost like if we're so blind, then in a way, maybe we need to live a little bit more vividly so that we could then start to get a glimpse of how we're operating. And therefore also we need each other's help in seeing. It's not just me with my microscope in my laboratory. But we need to help each other see how each of us is operating, to see through how we've come to operate. But that's so delicate, so that we're not just policing each other, or I can see how you're operating and you can't, kind of arrogance and sort of butchery. But to kind of let it sink in that we might have a blind spot or two to start with, and even physically, literally, our eyes have a blind spot. You can play with like where your second finger disappears because of the design of the eye. There's a place that we do not see. And so that could be, oh my God, we're even more vulnerable than I thought. We're even more poorly designed than I thought. Or it could be an invitation to kind of work together. One thing that we do start to see on retreat especially, but also in daily life, are the ways that habit energies take over. And it starts to feel normal to be that anxious or to be that, let's say, self-critical, or that thinking that I know. that starts to feel normal. And I think that that's how it is instead of how it has come to be experienced. So if we could play with the literal blind spots and the kind of temporary attacks of blindness that happen when the habit energies take over. We could start to discover how much of our life is driven by habit energy. And that can be really astonishing. It can be hard to take as a joyful thing. It's not that we must take everything as a joyful thing, as a requirement. For the Buddha, his way was not so much as taking everything as a joyful thing, but seeing the painfulness and being inspired to see more deeply into what is because of seeing painfulness. And there's this really lovely teaching that he apparently gave that was written down a couple hundred years after he died. I just find it so tender. And it's called the teaching of the dart, like the atadanda, the sharp stick. But it's translated as dart. And I'm calling this talk Operating Theater partly just to see how we could let life operate on us to do healing and cutting away without any aggression and without any kind of stoicism, trying to be strong or whatever, but just this tenderness. So I would like to read most of these excerpts that I've taken from this teaching of the Buddha. And he says that fear is what comes from resorting to violence. Just look at how people quarrel and fight. But let me tell you now of the kind of dismay and terror I have felt. So I just love how he's not just talking about his superhuman mind states, but he's talking about the terror and dismay that he felt in seeing us, all of us. And so if we thought that we were in a special state of crisis now in the world, we could think again, because listen. He said, seeing people struggling like fish writhing in shallow water with enmity against one another, I became afraid. I just find that so lovely. It's not like I hated them, or I thought it was wrong and I went to fix it, or he saw us competing with each other and trying to be better and thinking that we're worse and struggling in shallow water, trying to get a breath of the water as fish. At one time, so he became afraid, and at one time I had wanted to find some place where I could take shelter. So again, he wanted to go somewhere safe in the world. But I never saw any such place. So tender. I had seen them all trapped in mutual conflict, and that is why I had felt so repelled. But then I noticed something buried deep in their hearts. It was, I could just make it out, a dart. It is a dart that makes its victims run all over the place. But once it has been pulled out, all that running is finished. Once it has been pulled out, all that running is finished, and so is the exhaustion that comes with it. So sometimes in the theater of our lives, it's not a comedy, it's a tragedy. And we could just get caught up in the tragedy of things. Or we could keep looking despite our wish to get away from it all. We could keep looking and keep looking with tender eyes. Until we see what is making us operate in the way that we're operating. And when we see how simple the suffering is, how it all comes down to, we could say it all comes down to the shame. And we address that directly. So there's another teaching where the Buddha says, instead of trying to figure out where the arrow came from and who shot it and from which angle and what kind of wood is the arrow made from, etc., you just pull it out first and then see if you care where the arrow came from. You might not. So letting that direct expression of life, like feeling how painful it is to run all over the place, and just letting something reach through us, through our eyes to see what's happening, and then through our arms to just pull it out. So tragedy can work in the theater. We could see the habit energies running our lives, and we could feel what's behind that. What's making this habit energy run? What's making me believe this crazy story? So apparently where the word theater comes from is it's the place of seeing. Originally it comes from being a place of seeing. And one place we can see from is seeing the pain. So even if we see if we start to see, like for myself, it's been decades when I finally started to see some of my operating system of just trying to make everyone give some approval or confirmation or acceptance so that then I can be allowed to exist. But the only way I could be allowed to see that without completely kind of disintegrating is that I could feel that it's just painful. And it's not someone's fault. It so happens that way. Our training is such that there's an operating system that's gotten input. And it doesn't make us wrong. And it hurts. And it's not what we are. And we don't know what we are, because that's what we know. That's how we know everything, is through that. The habit energy, so what I mean by that is where there's destructiveness built in. Thinking I'm better, worse, same, comparing, competing, hating, fearing, where there's belief in separation. Belief is maybe a kind of too flippant of a word. There's a living of an experience of separation that we keep going back to as if that's really. When we talk about being realistic, we think that's where we have to go, to that place of separation, that place of experiencing separation. Our training seems to be such that most people that I meet, I don't know if I could say every single one, but probably, this kind of training where we've learned our strategies, our ways of operating. It's so deep that there seems to be the experience that if I would not do that, if I would not try to get you to like me, I would die. So for someone else, it might be, if I don't feel more powerful than you, I would die. If I don't feel a victim, I would die. If I don't, whatever it is. And there's the kind of different layers coming in. So the operating system that's behind everything is really hard to see because it's so subtle and because it shakes so much our sense of integrity. But even in seeing, it's also difficult to see, let's say, the anger the blaming, the judging, or whatever. And then behind that, the shame. If we can be willing to be shaken and still see. Then I think our places that have been hurt, because hurt happens, can actually work on us in a different way. Instead of accumulating more contraction, more reaction, it starts to be a place of clearing, a place that the unknown can come in. So it's almost like if some place has been hurt, it's almost like it understood that it's out, it doesn't belong to the system. And that ends up being a really good thing, because it doesn't belong to the system. So if that gets a little bit cleared, that place that knows I'll never be accepted, this part of me could never be accepted, at first hurts. And when we see that it's not really about being accepted or not accepted, so that can be softened. It's great that there's already a part of us that's like on the frontier, outside of the mainstream culture in us. It can see the theater from a different angle. And it hasn't been sort of colonized or whatever by the view that we came to think of as normal. And so from that, feeling how a wound can be a place where we have access to our depth in a new way, in a way that we don't have access when we think everything's fine and we're all together. It can allow us into, the words that came to describe this today are impersonal forgiveness. So it doesn't mean that we go and sort of make amends verbally and emotionally with everyone. We might even need to do the opposite in the daily life, interpersonal situations sometimes. We might need to say, I don't want to see you ever again. That could be. It certainly could be for a while, and in some situations it could be like for this lifetime. The most empowering and clarifying move that could happen. So what is impersonal forgiveness? If we're not talking about interpersonal or personal forgiveness. It's partly like accepting that there is hurt, that that's part of this theater. That is part of what we can see. And we don't need to close our eyes when we see it. It's partly accepting how we've all been conditioned to express in the way that we do. And so there's not fault. And how would it be to actually see clearly hurt, fresh and old hurt, and not go to blame, but still see? Part of what that does is it gives a lot of room for everything in us, in what we think of as me. A small example from my life that is related, I'm not sure if I can make you see how it's related, but I hope it will help clarify what I'm trying to say. I grew up in high school and then even more so in college as a very strong feminist. And then I went to India looking for my female teacher, and I ended up with a patriarchal old man with tattoos and was in the army, a wrestler, etc. So I got the comedy of that. And so it's been there have been different ways of living womanness and femaleness in the world. And I thought I'd kind of come around to come pretty much of a wholeness with that subject. And then I had a son. So he's male. And it's the kind of thing that can happen that probably, I'm not sure if it specifically happened to me, but seeing parents with children and seeing the children doing like gender stereotype things and kind of thinking the parents did something wrong here. And then seeing my son be obsessed with vehicles. And I can see how the cultural programming does also add to that, because he also loves to pretend to cook. He loves to play with bottles of lotion. He loves to wash the dishes, etc. But he really, really, really loves to play with cars. And I find it really works on me to see that. And even if I am partly involved in some conditioning that I'm not aware of there, and even if it is coming from somehow maleness, I don't know. But it certainly is happening. It really was kind of resolved something for me on another level about men and women and any other kind of gender there could be. That kind of like we're allowed to be different, not just in that way, not just in that kind of traditional black and white male-female way, but in every way. And who knows why. It gives a lot of relief of the part that would like to make everything come out the way I thought it should. So I'd like to talk about, in the theater, traditionally there were the tragedies and the comedies. And Buddhism takes that more tragic kind of approach. And so when we start off with a teaching that talks about, in the first line, fear, violence, quarrel, fight, dismay, terror, that's in the first two sentences, those are the words. So we know we're entering into a tragedy in the theater, which might be helpful in healing. And for me, I love this particular teaching. But we know kind of in a way that even if there's a resolution at the end, it's a kind of somber, it's a kind of tragic mood. With a tragedy, we kind of know from the beginning more or less how it's going to end. And within that, everyone is allowed, the villain and the good person and so on. We can sit back and let that be. Partly because we do know what the end is going to be. We don't get too excited that maybe it's going to come out right this time. She'll wake up just in time. But there's also the way, another way of entering the theater, the place of seeing, which would be comedy. And I do feel that somehow that tone of the Buddhist teachings towards looking at what's painful and being motivated by that to get relief, and only like from that waking up, okay, wait, something's not right here, and then not running away, looking, and allowing tenderness, okay, we come to accept our humanness and find a fulfillment that they would call superhuman. I think that it's a little too tempting for us now, that tendency towards focusing on the negative. And so to beware and to remember to cultivate also that comedy possibility. So even if sometimes it's almost just like replacing one operating system for another, it could be a step in the right direction towards seeing more clearly. If we notice that we're focusing on the negative a lot, We could try to see what we can see there, and then we could try to find comedy. Find another place of seeing that has a sense of humor. So another, again, kind of strange thing to bring into a Dharma talk, I think, but to give an example. It doesn't necessarily mean that what's happening in the scene is much different. It could be that something kind of painful is happening, and we're taking it, we're seeing it in a different way, we're taking it in a different way. So one example was giving birth to Gyan, and everything was going, not actually everything because we're both alive, but nearly everything was going against our vision of a nice, as one friend put it, I imagined I would be like the lotus opening in bliss and the child coming, stepping forward kind of thing. I didn't quite imagine that far, but that was the idea, more or less. And so let's say when we called the birthing center to say we were coming and someone else answered the phone who didn't know about the birthing center, it was like being suddenly in the Twilight Zone TV show. And when we went there anyway and there was no one there at 6 o'clock in the morning, freezing cold, it was still like, this is kind of like so terrible that something in the background thinks it's pretty funny, even at the time. And I won't go on, but there was even more once we got to the hospital from the birthing center 24 hours later. So sometimes in a very, let's say, like emergency situation, it can be actually easier to kind of step back and be in the flow and see the kind of, let's say, divine humor of a terrible situation. And so sometimes it's more challenging to be willing to step back that much and laugh at a more ordinary difficulty. And also not to laugh at, really. It's not laughing at, but it is laughing. There's one exercise that the teacher Byron Katie talks about. I don't know if she talks about it as an exercise, but we can think back to the worst moment of our lives and try to really feel into that moment if somewhere inside you were at least okay, if not in joy. And I would say, even if it's not like that has to be true for you, maybe you say, no, it's not at all okay. It could be worth, in the ordinary moments, not the worst moment ever, to just be in touch with that kind of willingness to be tickled. And I want to emphasize this ordinariness a lot. So in any of the different kinds of wounds or places of negativity that we might have bumped into already in these last few days, sometimes we might have already gotten a sense that it's mostly my resistance to the idea of the thing or the unpleasantness of the sensation that's actually causing a blockage or a paralysis or a stuckness. And when I kind of, as if it would be like that catching the eye, like actual eye contact with someone, it would be like catching the eye of the aliveness in that difficulty, that loneliness, sadness, fear, etc. And respect for that, like being tickled so that we could actually see the aliveness inside even a difficulty, could allow that to bring out its own clarity and kind of cut through from the other side. Like, we don't have to cut through to it. It just by meeting, and there could be a cutting through. That would be like taking out the dart. But also when we're kind of venturing into the unknown of like, what is going on here and what am I? And we really agree that we don't know, that we are venturing into the unknown. It would be really limiting to assume that everything we're going to find is about smallness and negativity. There's much more, I think I can honestly say there's much more that we are meeting and will meet that's scary for a different reason, that's unknown for a different reason. It's not unknown because it's so terrible. It's unknown because it goes so far beyond what we thought we could be. And when we're in touch with that, we know it goes against the rules. And so that makes it scary too. That's why when someone had an experience one time and said out loud, "I am God," and he was stoned or whatever, he was executed. And we could find ways of not calling attention to that wildness or that in us that we know is true, and we know it doesn't follow the rules. We could find ways of like probably not getting executed by maybe not trying to be really heroic with that, not just making that into a different kind of super ego, like superwoman, superman ego. To let it move us without making it into a thing. Just ordinary aliveness that doesn't follow the rules. Just resting back behind the sense of separation. Resting back even out of any agreements we made with external authorities, so the parents and the teachers and the culture that taught us to operate that way, but also even out of any kind of concretized inner authority. We could just actually lose interest in the whole subject of authority. Another way to say that would be life is, or aliveness is, the author. And so we don't know what the end of the theater is going to be. It might not have an end. And we can check our, like, somewhere in us, the programming of trying to get to the end of the play, like trying to get to the happy or sad, whichever one it is, just let's finish. We could feel how that's just programming. And a willingness to give ourselves to something unending. And ordinary. There's this lovely line in another text. I think it's in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. It just talks about, it's kind of walking us through, like, go deeper, keep going, go deeper, keep going, go deeper. And at one point it says, according to Ajay, who's my teacher and co-teacher also, and he might have made it up, but it feels very true. I think it's in the Yoga Sutra. At some point, we've kept going, kept going, kept going. And we don't know it, but we have, like, it would be as if having $100, or maybe nowadays it would be more like having a credit card or $1,000 in the back pocket. That was maybe 10 or 15 years ago that he used the example of $100. So let's say a credit card without a limit in the back pocket, and we don't know it's there. So it's on us, but we don't know it. And that's what's happening here, is like we're kind of being given credit, let's say. We're being given freedom and power of a real creative life. And we can't know it yet. Because what would we do if we did know it? We would just spend it on those silly things, all that habit energy. So in that text, it's talking about a specific stage that we will one day reach, let's say. But I think it also describes us, especially with this kind of softening practice, of letting something arise practice. So I want to give another weird example. I'm sorry, I hope it fits and makes sense. Because I really want us to feel how we do have what we need in the back pocket. And it does give us enough information to go on. And it's so ordinary that we usually can't be bothered. We can't be bothered to do that little thing that saves our lives. So I have a friend who is quite an amazing healer, but doesn't actually want anyone to know that. And doesn't do it much. But one occasion inspired him to do it, let's say. Someone was dying of heart disease at a fairly young age. I don't know if it was in the 40s or in the 50s, so younger than kind of normal or whatever. And went to my friend for help, and my friend said, okay, give me 10 days. We'll go to the mountains together for 10 days, and I'll cure you. And so they did. They just hiked around the Himalayas for 10 days and came back fine. But there was that little clause at the end, which was, we need to meet every year at least once. We just need to be together once a year. And so for many years after that, like, curing episode, the time it was passing, the year was passing, and they needed to be together, and the man who had been healed was so busy, he couldn't quite make it. Mm-hmm. And so my friend would go to him to give him that touch or whatever, that being together, that what was needed to keep, to sustain the healing momentum or whatever. And I think it was probably about 10 years like that. Not like saying anything and not mentioning, not complaining, not whining, whatever. And there came the point that my friend felt like he could come. This man who I have healed could come this year. And he didn't come. And he went to the mountains to die. Like, not just going to the other place to get healed. And he did die. So it wasn't that they had to meet to do some kind of weird seeming ceremony or some expensive, elaborate ritual or whatever. It was just to hang out together for maybe a day or even just a few hours. And it just couldn't quite fit in his schedule. Yes?
You said he died, the man with the heart disease?
The man who had been ill.
Okay, he died.
Died.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
So what I mean to say is there are those ordinary things that we could notice how they help, just to hang out with, not necessarily a person, could be, but it might be like the lake or the jogging or the resting or the cooking or whatever. Those things that we would tend to not get around to doing if we could be bothered. And the reason I gave that kind of tragic example is because people die every day, and people are born every day, like lots of us are born and die every day. And it's not as often that someone wakes up, that someone allows the full potential to, like, come out. So this spiritual life has an importance that we have a hard time bearing or giving to it. And if we could see how these gestures of ordinariness that sustain our momentum in flowering. It's better than saving our lives. I think one reason we postpone those ordinary gestures is that we have come to trust in force and power rather than to trust in love. We trust in power that communicates itself as should and as pressure. We think we need to do those things first. And then we'll be allowed, then we're allowed. And we could come to trust in love that has power, that is a creative force, but it communicates in love and clarity, in joy and clarity. While it's communicating as joy, it's hard for us to dare to follow the joy, but it's a very clear signal that we could be bothered to follow. And then sometimes, or after a while, there's not even that kind of feedback of you're on the right track, follow the joy. There's a kind of very impersonal, almost intangible clarity that we can follow. And what happens as we follow both the joy and the clarity one time one friend talked about we follow the light stream, so it would be like the movement that's appropriate. We could see inside as a light stream. We can follow the guidance, the subtle guidance that we do have access to. And actually let go of the ending that we had imagined that was pulling us towards it, that enlightenment or whatever that we thought we were working towards. Sometimes as a temporary measure, it could be worthwhile to kind of give ourselves the carrot, whether it's the joy, the clarity, the enlightenment, the credit card, whatever. It can work sometimes that we think there's a clear goal, but it really is useful to keep in mind that we just practice as if there's a clear goal while we need to practice that way, to kind of gather ourselves. So there's enough sharpness that arises out of the softness. It's just, we could call it rather precision. From the softness, not by trying to be precise. And then we get blocky and awkward and stressed. But from the softness and listening to that ordinary guidance and following through on those ordinary gestures, it starts to get really precise just by itself. And we can follow, we can join that precision. The French woman who's called the mother, who founded Auroville in India, a big eco-spiritual community, says that love doesn't need to destroy in order to transform. It just has the power, that creative power. It doesn't actually need to. When we think of sharpness, we could think of cutting down or cutting away. It actually doesn't need to kill off anything. It has such a power of direct contact, direct transformation. And so giving ourselves into that starts to bring up this precision. And as we let that have its momentum or gain momentum in our lives, and we need less and less our usual operating system, we don't need to practice so much of like focusing on a goal or getting to that end point. We could just let go of outcome altogether. And if you could imagine the feeling of if we would really practice concentration on an object for a good while, maybe a few weeks or maybe a couple of months. If we could imagine how just as when we exercise the body, we exercise the mind that way, and it does actually start to be more focused, even if that seems impossible. And if we would then let go of what we had been focusing on, but we keep that crispness, that responsiveness. With the spiritual life, it's so hard to value what it is because it isn't a thing that we could focus on. And we don't, it actually, we literally cannot know where it's going because it doesn't, let's say, know where it's going. It hasn't gone there yet. And still to give ourselves in that wholehearted, precise energy of practice. Is a revolution where we're giving up like the bargaining mind where, okay, I'll give all of this because I know I've got to get there eventually. I'm going to get that they describe in the texts. When we need a clear goal, we can use that. And then to start to play with not using that. More like thy will be done kind of mode. If we could actually focus on no outcome, on thy will be done mode. I read somewhere a study of like alternative healing prayer in a hospital. And in this particular study, which maybe it is inaccurate, maybe it was determined by the wish of the person who had a specific outcome in mind when they did the study. But it's interesting just to think of the possibility that it seemed in this study that the most effective prayers were not like, I hope your broken leg heals perfectly and I see you running across the field as fast as the wild horse next to you or whatever. It was, thy will be done. But if we could be as focused on that slippery as we could be on an image that we could elaborate, that's what's called for. Letting life operate through us. Seeing from the eyes of life. And letting love act in ways that sometimes look soft and sometimes look sharp. Is there any question? So let's just have a few minutes quiet together. May our gathering together and may our willingness to see things clearly as they are and to be as we are create a momentum of joy, clarity, love, and liberation in all directions.